You're listening to STP Radio. Hey, you are listening to STP Radio. This is your host, Mark Tomlinson, with my guest on this episode, Mr. Michael Larson. Michael, how are you?
Thank you. I'm doing good. Glad to hear from you.
Very good. Welcome to STP Radio. This is with great homage to what you and Matt Heuser had started with Twist. We're sort of continuing and trying to go new and exciting places. But as we talked recently, one of the things we might do is a Twist greatest hits.
That would be very cool.
Wouldn't it be cool? I thought it might be cool to actually invite some of the folks that were on Twist interviews maybe a couple of years ago and actually revisit some of the same questions and see what's changed, see what's new. That might be like sort of a refresh.
Yeah, I've oftentimes thought that because we recorded about 132 episodes and talked to a lot of different people over the course of almost 3 years. Wow. And so you got to think about this comes back to 2010 when we first started doing the first episodes, and we did the last we recorded the last episode around the beginning of 2013. So it's been almost a year and a half since we recorded the last one, and yeah, some things have changed. Some things in the industry, some places where people are working or their experiences have changed. And yeah, I think it would be very interesting to look back to see if certain predictions or certain things that we thought were, you know, hot and going to be interesting actually proved to be interesting, and things that we didn't necessarily give any credence to, if they've come to the forefront now and like, oh, hey, that's interesting. We didn't even consider that.
Exactly. Like, I heard the cloud is dead. Nobody's going to the cloud.
Wow.
I'm totally kidding. So with full respect for me, thank you very much for really taking some steps into the Twist world. And I think we wouldn't be continuing what I'm doing in the podcasting world if you guys hadn't dove in for testing. So thank you. I would also say, outside of folks maybe knowing you from the Twist podcast, some people will follow you on the live blogging of events, which I know you're actually avid. I've sat right next to you at ALM Forum recently when we did that. And it's actually the testing community is just passionate about socially blogging and tweeting everything that happens at any one of the events, because we're all very socially connected to some extent on the topics. But maybe one great question, just an opener question, would be to ask what should – if somebody were to say, who is that Michael Larson guy in the software testing world, what would you love them to say about you or like where you came from or what they learned from you?
Wow, that's – oh, goodness. That's a loaded question.
Of course it is.
I guess if anything else, I would like people to know that I am somebody who has – been very avid about trying to understand software testing and trying to improve my knowledge and my involvement in the overall testing community by just putting myself out there. Mm-hmm. And by trying to do some things that are, I hope, unconventional. And I don't think anybody in the testing community would know me at all if I hadn't started a blog mm-hmm. about 3 years ago called TestHead.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's been the thing that's taken up most of my time in the testing community. Although that blog and my desire to write it led to many other opportunities. And right. So I guess if there's anything above and beyond just me being a tester that I'd want people to know, it's that I'm somebody who believes very strongly in the idea of, if you want to do creative work and if you want to get involved in a broader community, sometimes the best thing to do is just show up and say, my sleeves are rolled up, what can I do? Right. And surprisingly, there's lots you can do. And once you start doing it and people start seeing that you're doing it, you'll get asked by other people to do other things. And if you're open to being willing to get involved and play around with stuff and learn yeah. while you're there and talk about what you're learning, well, then I right. guess that's where you get somebody like me that you are talking to right now. Because really, that's all that I've been doing for the past 3.5 years.
Yeah, and we talked briefly, although maybe folks would be good to know, you weren't always a tester. You came along, I think you said, maybe even through like a tech support kind of role, or what was it?
My forgiveness for anybody who has heard this story for the umpteenth time. I do apologize. But for those who have not, I personally love it just because it's one of the most improbable tales. Because when I was a teenager and a young, you know, early 20s adult, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life except for one thing, and that was to be a rock star. And I ultimately ended up being a singer in a variety of bands in the San Francisco Bay Area, primarily glam-based, which will surprise everybody who knows me today as they see this bald-headed man that I used to be part of that legendary genre that we love to refer to as the hair band scene.
Ironically, yes.
But that was what I was about for a long time. And I devoted most of my time and attention prior to that to being a musician and performing as much as I possibly could in as many venues as I could for a period of almost 10 years. During that time, I paid my way through when I was 17 years old, I tried to be a fashion model for a little while and had a chance to do that, but didn't make much money at it. It took a level of commitment and a willingness to be molded and shaped into something I didn't necessarily want to be molded and shaped into. So that didn't last very long, but it did give me. But that first experience with doing that gave me the desire, motivation, and the thought of, well, what the heck? Maybe I can do this. And that's where my musical career or aspirations started. And after several years of doing that, it's always interesting. You feel like I'm at the pinnacle of success and I'm going broke in the process.
Which I think there may be a lot of testers who think the same way. They're like, I'm really doing cutting edge testing stuff, but there's kind of a glass ceiling at calling myself a tester. But it's the evolution of that, when you got started, when did you dive into technology, taking that next step?
Well, that was one of the things that was interesting about it, because again, when you are a young musician and you don't have a lot of things to draw on, I mean, I was delivering pizzas and cleaning houses to make money. You know, I would say very little in the way of technology influence, with a few notable exceptions. And those notable exceptions were, I managed my various bands' databases. Yeah. which might sound ironic. A band had a database? Well, yeah, think about it. We have a mailing list and we had flyers that we would send out. I had 4 floppy disks that I carried with me. One of them had DBase 3 Plus. Yes, yeah. One of them had a Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet program on it. One of them was just a collection of, I don't even remember the name of the program that we used, probably like a precursor to Adobe Illustrator or something, you know, that we would use to make our flyers. And those discs were religiously guarded, and I carried them with me everywhere that we would go, and any place I could get a computer that I could add information to and update and save and bring someplace else. So, and in addition to that, I also had the opportunity through one of my bandmates, because at the little community college that I was attending at the time, they had a studio recording and arranging class. And one of the things that they were in the process of doing was wiring up a whole brand new soundboard and a bunch of stuff. Because this is when MIDI was first starting to become a thing, and being able to make it so that you could do some automated sequencing and automated mixing to be able to turn effects on and off and do them based on a time code and all that. That was kind of, wow, it seemed space age to me at the time. But I got in there with a soldering iron and two other friends of mine who were in the class, and we basically started from scratch and wired the board in, and that was a really cool experience, and I learned quite a bit from it. And the reason I mentioned that is that those experiences, just those two experiences, by the time I got to the point where I realized, oh my gosh, I am going broke trying to make it in this industry, and I need to get some work that's more lucrative than cleaning houses or delivering pizzas. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. It was time. Yeah,
it was time. It says, I need something more than this.
Yeah.
And so my drummer at the time, he says, oh, well, I work for – he at the time, he was working for an electronics company that did sound equipment and other stuff, and he was one of their sales engineers. Cool. So how did that work? He says, well, you know, I just went to a temp agency and I worked with them for a while and they brought me to this place and now this is where I work. He says, if you want, I'll introduce you. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Went in and talked to some people there, explained, these are the things that I did know. I didn't even really think too much about it. Well, I manage a database. I do spreadsheets. I, do some desktop publishing stuff and, things that I never, for the life of me, gave much beyond just I'm a user of these things. Yeah, and not even realizing that it had any real intrinsic value.
Or that it would be the tip of the iceberg or the door that just opens to a much larger world.
Right, exactly. A few weeks went by and I got a phone call back one day and said, hey, if you're interested, we've got a tech gig for you. Fantastic. Where is it? It's down in Menlo Park. Who's the company? And they said, well, they're a computer firm or they do something. She was having trouble trying to explain what it is they exactly did. They do something with the computer. So that, okay, sure. What are they? Let me look it up. Oh, they're called Cisco Systems. Now, mind you, this was in, by the time I got this call, this was at the end of February, 1991. They were just getting going. They had gone public as a company maybe a few months earlier than that. And I was just coming in as a temp. I didn't know anything about Cisco Systems at all. And in fact, they were calling me in because they called because they wanted somebody who had some housekeeping experience because they had a library that had been completely cluttered for ages and nobody was really using it. And they said, we need somebody who can come in and help us clean this. And they booked me for 2 weeks. Yep. And because of my housekeeping abilities, I'm like, oh, I can do this. And I knocked it out in 3 days.
There you go.
Which caught some people's attention. Like, well, what can we do with this guy for the next 3 weeks? And one of the managers there said, actually, I've got something that he could do. Let's see what he knows. And he asked me if I would be willing to sit down and help him and his team just with the task of erasing EEPROMs so that they could reprogram them for the system boards for the routers.
Right.
I thought, I've never done it before, but that's never stopped me. Show me what I need to do. And so exactly. There's this big bulk eraser, ultraviolet eraser on a desktop. And it's big. They had a five. I mean, just to give you an idea of this, they had a 5-gallon water bottle they cut the top off of. And they had filled it with erasable EEPROMs that had been pulled out of boards. And it was just sitting there.
Just a stack of them.
Just this big stack. Yeah, just cluttered. And so I would have to sit there and I used a little, They told me all about ESD and making sure I didn't do anything. But basically I sat there and I pried the pins and straightened them out and, put them inside a foam and erased them and checked them on this programming machine to make sure that they were clean. And then they said, we can type in these commands and various stuff. And they put me in front of a Unix terminal and I'd never been in front of one before. Yeah. But I saw, that looks kind of like DOS. Okay, and based on what they were doing, I could say, okay, that's the name of a program. That's, some flippity bits you throw at it, and that's the name of a file. And so, sure, I was able to do that. And since I was able to make that work and have that, some other people came out of the woodwork and said, who's the guy with the Bitech machine? Hi. And they introduced themselves to me. And another person that was in the group said, by the way, we've got a lab back here that I manage and run. And here, let me show you what we do here. And she brought me back in the lab and I was looking at the lab. And as I was looking around and seeing all the racks of equipment, I saw all the patch panels. And as I saw the patch panels, that little familiarity in my head popped up and I said, patch panels. Recording studios have patch panels.
Oh, yeah. Mixing boards, monitor boards, everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Patch panels mix and match, signals going from one end to another. And so I took that. I said, well, let's find out how similar this world is. And I just went talking and I said, so you've got all this equipment here and you got computers and I'm assuming this is intermediary equipment. You got patch panels. So basically if I wanted to get that computer on this side of the room to talk to that computer on that side of the room, and I just started following its wire. So if I plug this in here and I plug this over here and took this connection here and here and here, so can these machines now talk? And she just looked at me and like, yes. I didn't really, I just thought it was a conversation. I didn't realize that that same lady who was managing the lab walked up to the same person who was having me erase EEPROMs and saying, can we hang on to this guy?
Yeah, exactly. There's some aptitude.
And so it went from being a 2-week thing to a longer gig. And here's where it gets fun because that whole organization was the release engineering group. you know, as they say, a rose by any other name. These were the software testers for Cisco Systems at the time.
Right.
And so when everybody says, right, how did you get into testing? When the old phrase of I just fell into it is so classically said, no, really, I just fell into it. I had no training as a tester. I had no even experience as a tester. But I did have a little bit of a rough and tumble experience as a musician and a tinkerer and somebody who had been involved with having to do a lot of do-it-yourself stuff just to make things work. And that appealed to this group of people, and they thought he'd be a pretty good fit for us. I think we can work with them.
As you point out, the term self-describing unconventional, and also the idea that you started in a do-it-yourself, or this is really creative work. Would you say that you would see now testing in general is also creative work?
Absolutely, I would say it's creative work. It just by its very definition, I think what tends to happen. Now, when I say tends to happen, some people may feel very differently, but it is very easy, especially when you watch a company go from small to big. It is very easy to get consumed by process, and I witnessed that with Cisco. In its rocket ride up from a 300-person company to when I left, I think they had 30-some-odd thousand people working for them, and they got even more than that afterwards. But from the 10 years that I worked at Cisco, and yes, to spoil the story, yes, that contract gig did turn into a full-time offer of employment, and I ended up working at Cisco for 10 years.
Yeah.
Which was really cool.
Exactly.
But I also got to see what it was like to watch a company go from small and kind of scrappy and able to just do just about anything that they set their minds to, for very legitimate business reasons, for being able to do business in other parts of the world that demanded it, having to, in a way, become very regulated and regimented.
Sure.
And in that process, a lot of that sort of devil-may-care creativity, I also witnessed give way to more of a regimented and formal structure. And for a while there, it felt like a lot of the thing that was freewheeling and fun when I started became very routine and kind of everyday and commonplace. Okay. Part of me thought that it was just, well, I guess I'm maturing and I'm understanding this better, and I'm more able to do this type of stuff. And I didn't stop to think in any way, shape, or form that, hey, did all the stuff that drew me to this because it was sort of a do-it-yourself, you know, rough and tumble, devil-may-care approach to figuring things out, was being replaced by a much more formal, by-the-book, you know, follow these exact steps and write your test plan this formal way.
Right.
And I will admit it, I sort of went on, I went on autopilot after a number of years. And so I stopped looking at it as a creative discipline, and I started just thinking of it as, it's kind of my job.
Okay.
And after a while, that really was, I would say that for many years, that's what it became. It was good work. It paid well. I was able to, you know, get married and start a family and have kids and live a pretty nice life with it. But in many ways, it wasn't something that I was passionate about or really overly enthusiastic about. It was my job.
Boy, you know, when you introduce yourself as being an ongoing work in progress, you were not kidding at all. But there's a great lesson to share from not only your stick-to-itiveness, but there's also some, it's funny, I just talked about this with James Bach as well. There's an element of humility, real humility, that says, I may not know that, but, I'm going to go forward and provide value and help out and learn whatever it is needs to learn. And if you can do it fast enough, usually a company keeps you on and keeps you on and keeps you on, and you evolve that way. So fast forward to where you are now from Cisco, even just sort of in hindsight, how you got to what you're doing now. Was that the same work in progress, and what are the highlights that changed you the most?
Wow. Well, the 2000s were what I would call a if the 1990s were a rocket ride with one company where I got to go from what felt like to me success to success,
right.
The 2000s was a little bit of a crashing to earth and reassessing who I was.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, but by the end of the 1990s, I felt like, wow, man, I'm in this industry and I can go anywhere and be anyone and do anything. And by the end of 2003, I felt like I'm unemployable. Nobody wants me. What am I going to do with the rest of my life?
And you had been a tester for 10 years at that point in 2003. What was it what was that like?
It was frustrating. Sure. It was absolutely terrifying in a lot of ways. Uh-huh. One of the things that was humbling and helped me reset a little bit was I dropped out of college because again I was at the time I decided as I'm going to be a musician, I don't need a degree for this, and it was by kind of a happy accident that shortly thereafter I started working at Cisco and being surrounded by people who also didn't have degrees but managed to work their way up and do neat things,
right.
And I had that attitude with me. And I thought, as long as we're on this bull run, this is going to be fantastic. I don't need that. Well, I didn't realize that there are cycles in the tech world, and you can be on top of the world one day, and a couple of years later, just because of market conditions changing. My goodness, there's a glut of software testers out there,
right.
And now they're saying, they need you to have 5 years programming experience and ability to work with 7 or 8 different languages and basically be a junior level programmer, software developer, and being paid a third of what you're used to being paid.
And this is not only in Silicon Valley, where I know that is pervasive qualification, but it's happening in other small tech centers, obviously Seattle, it's happening in New York, it's happening in Minneapolis, it's happening. This is around 2003 to 2005 after the dot-com bust.
Exactly.
So how did you cope with that? What did you do to keep yourself
well,
going?
Honestly, the first job – so – to put this into perspective, after I left Cisco, I went to work for a company called Connectix. They were the virtual PC company and the Kinect cam, one of the early video camera companies. They actually sold that business to Logitech. But I got in. I was working with virtual PC, and it was really quite cool. I thought, man, I'm unstoppable. A year later, I was unemployed the tech industry has caught a cold, and we can't, our projections don't see us being able to hold the workforce we have. And I was brought into a room, and the CEO basically had us all sitting there. He walked in and very matter of factly said, I'm not going to keep you in suspense. I'm sorry, but this is a layoff.
Yeah.
And that was the first for me. I mean, I've been underemployed, like as a housekeeper or a pizza delivery person, but this was the first time in about 12 years that I was like, wait, I'm being fired. Or I'm being laid off. It's the same thing if you get down to it. But
those doors that were once naturally opening for you
are closing.
And that was
a frustrating and humbling experience to go through.
Yeah.
And I talked to friends. I went and I interviewed, and I found that it was not so easy to get a job. And I had an opportunity to work with a company, and I've written about this extensively on my blog.
Yeah.
And so I went to work for a company called Synaptix down. And so if you ever had your touchpads on many of your devices, on your PCs or that little pad that you run your finger across to move the mouse, the iPhone screen for that matter, is a Synaptix product or similar.
Yeah.
And so many of those devices, there's a certain level of understanding of physics and understanding of that I just honestly did not have, but I was under the impression, well, I'm a tester. I can learn how to test anything. And I believed that up until the point that it was kind of proven, I was kind of proven wrong. And that was really humbling for me too. So so within 2 years, getting laid off again, because I really wasn't able to meet the requirements that they and hope that I had. And that kind of scared me. I thought, oh no, have I run the gamut of what I can possibly do? Am I actually in a position to be viable? now.
Yeah, and thinking of your career, as many testers think about their career, at times it's, when do I go back to the formal education? Is that what's holding me back?
One of the things that was messing me up from even getting calls or even getting a possibility was I didn't have a degree. And at the time, I thought, well, okay, maybe it's time for me to do this. And that's what I ultimately decided to do. I said, all right, let's put it together. Let's see what I have. How far away am I from getting a degree? And I realized, okay, I have enough credits that I could probably start as an upper division, you know, start as a junior, so to speak. And if I put two solid years into it, I could probably get a degree done. So I did. I went back and I decided to go for an IT degree. You know, I know that some people love to, you know, poo-poo or make disparaging comments about the University of Phoenix, which is where I went. But I went there not because of, you know, I honestly went there because I'm a married guy with three young kids and I need something that's flexible.
Yeah.
I don't know when I'm going to be available to do.
You're not a 20 something going back to live a campus life.
Absolutely not.
And it's also, what did you choose to in IT? Is it just information systems generally? Was it programming?
It was information systems generally. Again, I kind of thought about the fact that, you know, with being a software tester, why don't I just make sure that I've got the credentials and got the stuff that I need so that if, I happened to come into the job where I could do a network, be a lab administrator. If push came to shove, could I do that again?
Yeah.
I figured I could. So why not update it and be able to say, here, this is what I know how to do.
Sure.
And now I've got a piece of paper that says I know how to do it. So yes, I went in with an information systems approach, and that's what I wanted to cover for. And I said, sure, for 2 years, I can make this work. And we've got enough money here, and if I have to, cool. And I thought, honestly, that's what I thought I was going to do. I was just going to go back to school. I was going to retool. I was going to focus on school. And that was going to be the main thing I did.
Yep.
What was funny, though, was that because naturally, at the time, every job that I had ever gotten or seemed to have been getting at that point had come from Craigslist. And so I was looking at Craigslist and I saw a job description that said, we are looking for a quality assurance engineer with an excellent singing voice. I went, what? Hold on a minute. And so I went back and I reread it. I thought, you know, actually what they said was quality assurance engineer, blah, 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 that, you know, all the details with it. Excellent singing voice, a major plus was. And so that I was too curious. I have to know what this is.
Yeah.
And so I just sent them a quick reply. I said, hey, I came across this job description. It's software tester. I got 10 years of it. And if you're looking for for excellent singing voice, I'm not sure what you define as excellent, but I played in the San Francisco Bay Area club scene and I was a singer for 10 years and I've got the CD to prove it.
You've got 20 years experience in both of those categories.
Yeah.
There you go. You get them together.
Exactly. And so they contacted me and it turned out that it was Konami of America, or Konami Digital Entertainment,
right,
the video game company. And they explained why they were looking for a QA singer. They were about to release a game franchise called Karaoke Revolution, which fit along with their Dance Dance Revolution games.
Yeah,
In this case, instead of testing out your feet and how fast you can move them, it's testing out your voice and how well you can sing to a game and to package songs. And I thought it was interesting. I thought, I've never done anything like that before. Sure. And so I came in and I started working with them. And I got to tell you, when people think of the idea, many people think when they think about getting into software testing video games is the immediate first jump. And I know people who've said that. Yeah, I tested video games, and that's the first thing that they say.
Because it sounds exciting. Like, I'm going to test video games. That'll be cool.
Yeah, believe me, the excitement wears off very fast because there's a big difference between playing games and testing games.
Yeah.
When you get a visual thing and you're doing polygon integrity test, and if you've never heard that term before, a polygon integrity test is where you take your game character and you basically go to the very far edge of the screen and you rub them across the screen.
Yes. You try to exploit all the edges. Yeah.
And jump to see if you fall through, see if the physics engine fails, to see if you
walk
through objects and get stuck. I mean, that's a very typical thing to do with a video game. And it's tedious.
But you did get to do some singing, though.
I did get to do some singing, and they actually set me up in my own little room so that I could not disturb everybody else. And I got to work with a few other people on the team with that. And that was pretty cool. I got to lead that project for a while, and then I got to work in some other avenues, also doing some customer support.
There is something natural about not just your background and having been a tester in the past. Your mindset is sort of – that came first, or your perspective, or the way you think. The way you're put together as a person is what – do you believe there are people who are like you, just you're naturally always going to end up being a QA testing person?
I think yes. I made this thing from a book that I remembered reading when I went back to school. It was called Peak Learning. That's the book. And in the book, they describe two different ways of looking at the world and ways of thinking. And the two ways that they describe, one of them is as what they refer to as groupers, and the other one that they refer to is as stringers. And so the idea is, if you are somebody who likes to see things in a whole, you like to see the holistic big picture of something,
right,
and then you like to dive in and take it apart,
yeah,
to see its constituent parts and how they fit together, you're probably a grouper.
Okay.
If you're somebody who loves the idea of taking a pile of small little parts and physically putting them together to make other components that you can then physically put together to connect to other components to ultimately make the whole, you know, the opposite direction.
Right.
You're probably a stringer.
Okay. And before you go on, what's the citation? Where are you?
Okay. So the book that I was referring to is called Peak Learning. It was written by Ronald Gross.
Okay.
And so its subtitle is How to Create Your Own Lifelong Education Program for Personal Enlightenment and Professional Success.
It seems a perfect fit for what you've been telling us, for sure.
Yeah. And this book was the one that makes that emphasis on what it's like, you know, the two mindsets. And
right.
And again, I'm grossly oversimplifying it.
Sure, but one thing I pick up from that is they're both an interconnected way of thinking about a system.
Right.
Just different. They start at different ends of the spectrum, maybe cognitive.
Yeah, I think so. And again, also we shouldn't say, well, I'm a grouper, and that's, you know, I think totally different. Every one of us is a little bit of both.
Sure.
You know. But like for me personally, I mean, I can program. I've done many different stints and many different focuses where I've gone in and I've done programming. I understand it. I can read code. I can write code. But it's not my natural inclination. The idea of sitting down and writing a program and making a program work and debugging a program and getting it to the point to where it's able to do something and then build it out from there, it's foreign to my way of thinking. But if you give me a system that's already put together and ask me to see if I can find places where it's not working well or where there might be problems with it, that's my natural instinct already, is to say, hey, what does this do? Oh, this is cool. Where does this take me?
Right.
How about if I do this? What if is my favorite question.
Okay.
And so because of being able to ask the what if, that's where I came to a conclusion a long time ago. That even if I do spend the time, even if I do get to a point to where I'm a solid programmer and I can do lots of programming and be an exceptional, you know, journeyman programmer per se, given my choice of the matter, I would probably say, okay, I got the choice between doing programming or doing active testing. I would choose active testing just because that's the way that I personally like to interact with systems. And I enjoy being the outsider trying to get in. Yeah. What's this doing? How is it doing it? What's the wiring under the board? What if I put this little wire here? What'll happen? Can I change the color of that light bulb?
Yeah. And to some extent, that advice you would give to new testers considering their careers, that unconventional, creative work to test something like, what can I do to get in, get around the edges and take something apart in that way?
I think so. Yes, absolutely. If that is something you struggle with, and if you're not necessarily one who likes to think in that capacity, and you find that going in that avenue or trying to be someone who thinks about problems that way is a challenge or is struggling for you, then yeah, maybe software testing might be a bit more of a struggle. It might be a harder environment to work in. And I think many people, when they start doing software testing, the idea is, well, we'll just, you know, people use our product. We'll just get users to use our product. Anybody can test, right?
Yeah, well.
And of course, those of us who've done it long enough know, no, that's not necessarily true.
Or much like your experience, you can get only so far. Let me put this question right. Do you think testers need to present themselves constantly with testing problems to learn this about themselves, whether they're a group or a stringer? In your case, maybe you were out of a testing job for a while. Were you still testing in your mind even when you weren't testing? And should testers always be challenging their minds in that way?
Irrespective of what I did at any given time, I say yes. I think once you've determined that you enjoy, or once you determine that you are somebody with an aptitude for testing, I don't see how you can avoid it. I think it just always happens.
Yeah.
What I would say to that, though, is I think it's important that if you do want to be a software tester who is good at your craft, that you take the time and you put the energy in to keep working on it. It's all too easy to fall into a pattern to do exactly what your stories tell you to do or what your company tells you your test plan has to do. And you start just following the script. It's rote. You just do whatever you need to do and you just work your way through it. And sometimes we can delude ourselves into thinking, well, I'm skillful now. I've learned what I need to learn. I know what I need to know. I'm good at what I do. And it may be, but sure, you might also be deluding yourself by thinking that, I know what I need to do now and I'm effective as a tester, where really what you've done is you've learned a small avenue that will bring you a little bit of understanding and experience, maybe, but you're denying yourself the opportunity to look even further afield in ways that would be more meaningful and more effective, and to become a better tester, to become a more effective tester. And I had those same situations at a given point where I thought, you know, I felt like I was okay. I felt like I was doing a semi-decent job, but it did feel like a lot of those bigger problems, a lot of those things that were much more catastrophic or much more dangerous or not such easy things to find were being found by other people. And I couldn't quite understand, what is it about them that they can find those problems and I can't?
Yeah.
What am I missing? And that was one of the things that I realized. I think testers need to have an opportunity to practice. And in addition to having an opportunity to practice, to communicate with others that aren't necessarily their immediate peers. Because if you only communicate with your immediate peers, you're going to basically exhaust what they know, and then you're not really going to get an opportunity to learn much more. That's why I love being involved with initiatives like weekend testing, or one of the reasons I got into the Association for Software Testing and at first taking and then helping teach their black box software testing classes. For me, the real net of that and the real benefit of being part of that is that every time I get a chance to teach a software testing class and we get 25 new people in those classes, I get to see a bunch of different perspectives. And those perspectives are not the same ones that I deal with every day. And so I'll see people answer the questions that we have. And so the material at this point I've gotten to know pretty well, but everybody comes at it from a different angle. And because they're coming at it from their own experiences, I'm able to see nuances that I hadn't seen before. And each time I do the class, I learn something new about material that I thought that I knew cold.
Because you've got new input from a different new energy, new experience, new thoughts.
Right.
And is that something that these are great avenues, the BBST, the Black Box Software Testing Class, AST, you mentioned weekend testers, which are pretty much free and open. There's also summer camp we've talked about recently, summer QA
So summer camp is a different initiative. Now is a good time to talk about it, of course, because we're heading into summer, which is nice.
That's true. Yes.
And summer camp is a program that the Obama White House and the Summer Jobs Plus program helped get together a couple of years ago,
right,
in the idea that we could reach out to students that were between the ages of 16 and 24, and particularly students who may not come from a traditional, STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics background. And could we help them learn enough and come in a place to where they could be interns as software testers?
Right.
And somebody from the summer camp program actually contacted me and says, I agree. I'm a software tester, a lifelong one. At this point, he was the vice president of quality assurance for a company at that point. But he says, I'm a software tester and have been my whole career. And yes, I would love to see a way that we could partner on this.
That would be cool.
In that capacity, we started working on materials that would make a quick and fairly shallow but broad introduction to a variety of software testing topics. It's by no means it's not a semester's length college course in software testing. It's not designed to be. It really is designed to be. If you are interested in applying for an internship, we'd like you to take maybe a week or two to go through all this material and read up on it and practice with it and answer a few questions. And if you feel like this is a good avenue, then yes, you might be a good fit for this program. And so it's not something that anybody can just go, oh, hey, I'll go to summercamp.org and sign up to be part of. If you do happen to be a student between 16 and 24, then yes, you can go there and say, I'd like to apply and check in on this and get this to happen. But that process for me, going through and finding all the materials and really software testing materials, they're rich, they're varied, they're dense. There's a lot.
I was going to say, when you and I were starting just 20 some years ago, testing was it wasn't the career that I think it is now. And so part of the programs you're describing, not just with summer camp for younger individuals to jump on board, but even there's folks who are like you have reinvented yourself in your own career path as a tester. We have people joining weekend testers that were like, well, I've been a programmer for a while, but now I'm switching gears. Maybe I'll try testing. And I'm getting inquiries from all over the world to jump on some of the SDP programs and things like that as well. So there's a lot more opportunities in a new tester's career versus trial and error and doing EEPROM scrubbing. and patch panels.
Absolutely.
Or singing into a QA singer. But there's a lot more formal materials, like you say, rich and dense, to help people get started. We didn't get a chance to talk about estimates, so would you come back again sometime in our near future to talk about crappy testing estimates?
Sure thing. I'd be happy to.
Would you like to give a shout out to anyone? Maybe where you're going to be in the next couple of months, maybe teaching, CAST, or what events do you have coming up?
Actually, yes, I would love to give a shout out. CAST 2014 is being held in New York City, and in August, I believe it's the 11th through 14th, 11th through 13th. Is the conference for the Association for Software Testing. Yep. And I'm excited this particular conference because, yes, I am speaking, but I am speaking, interestingly enough, in this capacity that we just described. I'm doing a co-speaking engagement with Harrison Lavelle, who is a graduate of the STEP program through Perscalis, which is another group that we could have mentioned in all this. And I'm sorry.
Another mentoring opportunity, but another mentoring opportunity, similar to summer camp. Yeah,
exactly. Yes. And Harrison is somebody that I have been mentoring, and he's been doing a fantastic job. He's gotten into software testing from their program. And we're going to be co-presenting on a topic called Coyote Teaching.
Very cool.
Which, again, kind of fits very much into a lot of what we're discussing. Self-discovery. How do you know that you are able or are capable of doing something? How can you learn if you're capable of doing something? And coyote teaching is not a new phenomenon. It's been around for a number of years. It's actually much more well-known when it comes to outdoors programs and wilderness survival. But we thought it would be fun to say how much of that relates to technical knowledge acquisition and how much of that works into just the way that people think and the way that people approach problems. And Harrison and I have been experimenting with a lot of that through our mentoring relationship. And we realized the answer is quite a bit. There's a lot of follow-over, and there's a lot of neat ideas with it. And if you're thinking to yourself, coyote teaching, that sounds wild. What's that all about? You should get yourself to CAST and find out.
And find out more, exactly. What else you got going on? Summer camp is happening again?
Summer camp is happening. We're definitely working on that. At this, interestingly enough, I've received an invitation from Eurostar because when they were doing their green tester, it looks like putting on a pirate cap and holding a cutlass in my mouth for a camera gave them an opportunity to have a great picture to say, okay, yes, we want you at our conference.
We want you at our conference, yes.
Fantastic.
You have to get back to slaying some bugs
absolutely.
In software after that, for sure. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and we hope to see you also. You've been at SDP Cons with me in the past doing live blogging there, so hopefully we'll see you at SDP Con coming up sometime in the future. That'd be cool.
I think we could probably work that out.
Yeah, and we'll have you back on SDP Radio. We'll do a special episode on estimates. That would be okay. I promise we'll get back to it. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Thank you for listening to another episode of SDP Radio. As your host, it's my pleasure to bring these intriguing and engaging conversations to assist you in your quest to become a better software tester. Please be aware that this podcast is a production of the Software Test Professionals Organization and is copyrighted and protected via the Creative Commons Share with Attribution Non-Derivative Licensing. For more information, please visit www.softwaretestpro.com. And don't forget, this upcoming November is the SDPCon Fall Conference in Denver, Colorado in the USA. Between now and then, there are multiple online training events coming up on performance testing, risk-based testing, testing automation, agile testing, and software test leadership. Visit www.softwaretestpro.com/training to find out more. On behalf of myself and the entire SDP community, please share this podcast with your fellow testers and developers and managers. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us on the next episode of SDP Radio.